that's horrible. Computers are horrible.
This is Up Up Down Down, the only show about video games that you are currently listening to. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical, later Activision, and is now co-founder of Steam Clock. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us is Guy English. Guy has worked in the game industry for Ubisoft and Tapulous, but since founded Aged and Distilled, where he builds excellent Mac apps like Napkin. Hi, Guy.
Hey, man.
So our topic for today is flickering ghosts, quirks, and hacks that make games work, which is not necessarily games criticism. It's more the fun side, and or at least to us, the fun side of games. We all have our own sort of pet stories and favorite stories of quirks and hacks that make their way into games that maybe in other types of software you would say, oh, we should probably do it the quote unquote right way or the accurate way. But that's not what games are about. They're about being fun. And so more and more of these bizarre things make their way into games. So I thought a good way to start would to kick it to Guy for what would be your nomination for a particularly fun quirk or hack that made it into a game that you worked on that might be surprising?
I've got a couple of things. One of the things that I keep coming back to, these are old school techniques. Like,
don't do this at home.
Yeah, this should never have been done anyway. But so one of the old things was on a DOS game. We had compiled sprites, which basically is we would take the sprite, which is a bitmap, and turn it into computer code that would execute on the CPU. So rather than like copying eight, single pixels of white, we would use like the move instruction and just flat out set the white pixels directly in code. So we would generate the code and then just jump to it. So rather than like your sprite routine copying bits, it would just execute code and render on the screen, which was fast and totally bananas to do these days.
And completely impossible to maintain or make sense of.
Oh, it's just, it's the worst, But I mean, it's DOS, so whatever. It worked enough. And that's kind of my pinnacle of like the craziest, dumbest, short, not, it was clever, but dumb in a good way sort of thing.
It seems the more I talk to people who've worked in the games industry, the more stories there are of things that are quote unquote dumb. Like, I can't believe I ever wrote that. But there's always a sense of pride because it shipped and it was fast and the game worked. And that kind of, it's a success, even if it's this insanely stupid or naive way of doing something.
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of the fun thing about games is that it's an artifice, right? Like if it's fun to play and it works, then job done. Doesn't really matter how you made the sausage.
I think the it was fast thing is another key point. Like the hack that Guy just talked about and a couple of the ones I've got on my list are often performance related hacks, and games are really different from other software in a number of respects. But one of the ones that I think is the most significant is the performance aspect of things. Like almost all other kinds of applications that you take on have sort of a good enough limit for performance, right? You can say at some point like, we have to optimize this like web page request handling time. But once we've hit some point, it's good enough. But games just have this bottomless pit of desire for performance. Like you can always get some improvement in the game by making it a little faster, whether it's like one of your things that wasn't quite running at your maximum frame rate now does, or you can put in one more enemy in some place. There's always something that you can benefit from by increasing performance a little bit. And that's one of the things that really I like about game programming. It's one of the things that I focused a lot on when I was in the games industry, was doing that kind of performance optimization. And that leads to a lot of these just like not so hacks that you would never be willing to pull in any other kind of application because the performance just wouldn't be worth it. But in games, it's like, yeah, if you can optimize like some inner loop by 10% and that gives you back like actual 10% of your frame rate, like that's huge.
Yeah, you give that to a designer and then they burn 20% because they're jerks like that. But one of the things that differentiates games from other software too is that games don't have to be correct. Like, you don't need the correct answer. You need to simulate something very quickly. And if you can, you know, for any other kind of software, when you optimize it, you need to get the same correct answer. In many cases in a game, you can kind of fudge the answer. So long as it all works out and is fun in the end.
Well, sometimes the incorrect answer is more fun. Like I was once talking to Nigel about racing games, and I sort of said, oh, I don't know how fast I was going in this game. And he pointed out that a lot of racing games, you actually go insanely fast. Like, not, you know, a car that might normally go 100 miles an hour actually can go 200 or 300 or 500 as far as the game scale makes sense, because it's more fun. And yeah, whatever. No one's going to clock your car in the racing game.
Oh yeah. I mean, we had a huge amount of those kinds of things when we were doing the Hulk Ultimate Destruction game at Radical, you know, trying to do like superhero physics. And you know, even you say like, all right, well, Hulk has this enormous jump strength, right? And so you like, you know, take a human and give him like this incredible jump strength and then put him in a world with normal gravity, and you try it and it just feels like you float, right? like you say, if
orbit.
Someone could actually jump this high in real life, it would feel like they were up there forever. And I don't know how far exactly they ended up cranking the gravity on that game, but it was like significantly higher than normal Earth gravity, like triple or quadruple normal Earth gravity that they ended up going with to make it feel like Hulk had that weight to him.
Right, because even though extra mass doesn't cause you to fall faster, it feels like it should. It feels like Hulk should fall really fast and go boom.
Yeah. And I think they even had various times that they cranked up the gravity, that like, you know, maybe it was only like 2x normally, but then whenever he'd do like his ground pound move, like that's what they do, is they just crank the gravity up even further during the fall from that.
Man, the Hulk is awesome.
I love that any of those times in games where people complain like that something wasn't realistic. And obviously, obviously, if it was completely realistic, it would be incredibly boring. Like, right. Well, your character needs to go take a leak now. So.
Yeah, Super Mario Brothers, being an active plumber is not actually that exciting.
No, and no. It's very different than the game.
Little bit,
as far as I know, never having been a plumber.
Yeah, never had a fireball thrown at me.
Exactly. So my favorite sort of story of these hacks, and that's what I mentioned it in the title of the show, is from Pac-Man for the Atari 2600. I'm not sure if either of you played the 2600. So
I think I have played the 2600 version of it, though not recently, certainly.
Yeah, it's been a few years.
So this is a sort of famous behavior of this port. I mean, obviously Pac-Man, the original arcade game, most successful arcade game of all time, at least at that time, and really well-tuned and a very popular game. And they figured, okay, well, let's port this over to Atari, which is, you know, really popular home game console at that time. And they figured it should be easy because Pac-Man is not impressive because of its graphics. It's impressive because of the gameplay. And so at the time, the systems are weaker than the arcade consoles, but it should be feasible. But the problem was that you, on the 2600, you can only animate two sprites at a time per frame. So that's cool, except that Pac-Man has five. They have the four ghosts and then Pac-Man himself. So you're boned, right? Except that what the programmer did is he made it so that each ghost only paints itself one out of every four frames. And then the phosphors of the CRT keep the ghosts alive, like in this flickering sense. So if you look at it now, it looks like I looked up a video of it and I'll link it in the show notes. It looks kind of hilariously bad. They're just like flash, 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 flash. But at the time, hey, I have Pac-Man at home and it was the best selling the best selling console game of all time. 7 million copies based on this crazy hack where they're flickering like mad for no particular good reason, but they're ghosts. So I guess that's why they flicker. And I just thought that was a really cool workaround for something. Like I would have looked at that and said, oh, well, it's impossible. We can't port this game. We can only have two moving sprites in there. Just like, ah.
That kind of stuff carries over to modern games. Like having worked on a couple of open world games like Hulk Ultimate Destruction that I mentioned and the two prototype games, I mean, obviously, we don't have those kinds of extreme limits on modern consoles anymore, but there's way less stuff in the world in a lot of those open world games than you would think by looking at it. That we were always extremely aggressive about recycling, like pedestrians and traffic vehicles and stuff like that, such that really all of the simulating stuff in the world was kind of in your field of view. And if you turned around, you know, the whole world basically just like vanished behind you. And you know, we could do that in like debug mode in the game of like flip on an external camera that doesn't have any of that logic tied to it and run the character around in that mode. And there's basically just like this cone of like pedestrians and traffic cars in front of you. And then an empty world behind you and you turn around, like everything in front of you just vanishes and reappears behind you as you turn, and then you turn back and there's a completely different set of things there than there was last time you looked away.
It's totally that thing. It's like with, you know, if you close your eyes, the world stops existing, but it's actually true for the simulation. Would you guys do a lot of imposter stuff too?
By imposters, you mean like low resolution,
yeah, so
far away versions?
Yeah. Or, you know, like you render the background into a bitmap and then.
We didn't ever render any of the background stuff down. Like the pedestrians in the distance were way lower resolution, right, and in some cases not animated or lockstep animated. You'd have like, okay, there's 10 pedestrians here and we're just going to make them all exactly the same model. And then we only need to skin it once and can just render out like the 30 polygons that make it up in one go. The only render down and composite thing that we ever did in the prototype games was we did that for particle systems because particle systems are huge in terms of fill rate.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, you've got these like 10 or 20 layer, like half the screen polygons all overlapping. It's really easy to blow out your fill rate targets. And so what we do is we'd render the particle systems to like a half resolution buffer and then composite it on the screen. I think it only did that if the frame rate got low enough, like that sort of measured the rendering time for the particle systems and would try and render them at full resolution. And then when the fill rate was just getting too much, it would drop down to rendering them in like a half resolution buffer and scaling them up.
Yeah, that's another cool thing about games is that since it's a simulation, you have a feedback loop, right? Like you can do stuff like that. You can time how long something's taking you and then take the cheap route whenever possible.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Or just have less things on screen or what have you.
Yeah, like in the case of particles, you can drop them down in terms of numbers. But even then, like so particle systems are interesting because it touches on the fill rate issue where you can maybe simulate a crap load of particles, but if they're all sort of alpha blending into the screen, you can very quickly, I mean, you're redrawing the same pixel. Like,
so the fill rate, how many times. For those of us who aren't game developers, most people think of people who are not game developers are familiar with the number of polygons you can put up on screen at a time or maybe the gigaflops of a system. But one of the important bottlenecks in a system is how many pixels you can paint through the pipeline onto the screen per frame. And if you are doing something where you paint a whole bunch of pixels and then you paint on top of that and on top of that and on top of that on top of that in just one frame, then you actually hit that, even if it's a simple scene, but you paint it over multiple times. That tends to be a problem, which is something I wasn't familiar with until I kind of dove down with Nigel over drunken complaints about various games.
Well, like early iPhone stuff, that was a pretty major issue. And one of the reasons that they told you not to use a lot of alpha blending early on was precisely because you were hitting the fill rate limit.
Yeah, it was atrocious just even having one thing be transparent, like a toolbar. Because even on the original iPhone, they had that concept of the semi-transparent toolbar, and then you would have this table view scroll behind it. And so anyone who was sort of aping the style in the system apps, I was like, oh, yeah, you can just throw on that transparent toolbar. But just doing that 44 pixels by 320 pixels at the top of the screen and painting it twice and then blending it and painting it again is just was so slow you could not reasonably scroll at 60 frames a second, just some plain text table views. It was crazy.
And the thing about alpha blending is it's resistant to a lot of nice graphical optimization techniques. Like as rendering has gotten higher poly and better, like new tricks have become available to cut down on fill rate. So something that changed with sort of the last round of console generation is you went from doing all your rendering in like a single pass where you just say, all right, it's time to draw things. We're gonna draw everything, to doing what's called the Z pre-pass, where you fill the Z buffer on the graphics hardware first, and then you come back and render the real scene. And this is a great technique for cutting down on fill rate. Like fill rate used to be a problem for opaque geometry as well, because if you're, you know, if you're drawing a whole bunch of polygons and you're not doing something like that, like the Z pre-pass, you can get some of that same cost even with the opaque world. But you do the Z pre-pass, you put everything in the Z buffer first, and then when you draw it again, you only need to touch pixels on the screen that are actually visible. So at the same time that the individual pixels got way more expensive for the opaque world for doing like more complicated lighting and stuff like that, you know, the hardware also got fast enough and had a way of sort of treating the frame buffers and stuff like that general purpose enough that you could go to Z pre-pass and get that performance back. But you don't, there's no related trick for alpha blended stuff, right? Alpha blended rendering is still very primitive compared to the techniques that are available for opaque rendering, and you end up burning a lot more fill rate on it.
Well, it's really hard to cheat, right? Because you sort of need to do it accurately. For the Z pre-pass, you have the benefit of being able to reject stuff, but the alpha blended stuff can't. It basically doesn't interact with the Z buffer in the same way because you can see through it.
Yeah.
So you can't reject a pixel based on whether or not it's, you know, you actually have to just go and do the actual math, the per pixel math. You know,
every layer of the alpha blended poly does, in theory, affect the final pixel
exactly
on screen.
Yeah, you can't really tell.
This is a general, it's a wealth of hacks in this world of anything that's transparent. And I often when I we talk about times where there's like a common thing I complain about, and because it looks really cheesy, and it's been going away in the last generation of consoles, but when you have a character or any object in a game that's 3D fade in, they don't normally fade in, or at least they didn't used to fade in as a character. It's like their individual polygons would fade in. So if their hand has a whole bunch of pieces to it, it actually, the pieces of his hand blend against each other, and you can see the edges of the triangles in their hand because it's so expensive to figure out what the entire guy looks like and then flatten that and then blend that and make him fade in or fade out, as opposed to just fading every individual triangle and just sort of sucking it up that it looks kind of like a pile of junk.
Yeah, you'd have to do a crazy amount of work for that. Even if you rendered him or the fading in object to a texture and then sort of composited that into the scene, even that would have problems because you would lose all of the Z data. All his depth data would be gone as you put it into a texture.
You probably could work around that now. Like you can use various tricks with pulling in Z textures and stuff like that. I can't remember. We tried doing that for some translucency effect once. And the other thing is that rendering translucent objects, like even setting aside the issue of the polygons overlapping and doing weird things, like actually rendering translucent objects that look translucent is something that's hard, right? Like it's not just the polygons anymore, right? An opaque object you can approximate by just having all the surfaces of it there. You don't need to care about what's inside, but a real translucent object that's got significant mass that the light's shining through has all sorts of internal reflective and refractive properties that are hard to render in any reasonable way. Another, you know, sort of hack that we've pulled a couple of times with stuff like that for doing things like cloaking effects like that is not even doing them by rendering an object at all, but doing them by like permuting the backdrop. So I think for, I'm trying to remember what game it was for. One of the games we had an enemy that had like a predator style invisibility mode. And yeah, what we ended up doing was not rendering, like the character that we rendered actually just had the background applied to him. So we'd render the whole scene and then go back and render the character using the scene that we just rendered as the texture for that character, but permuting it a little bit. So it got a little bit of flicker in it. So it was basically like a picture of the background pasted onto the character rather than making any effort to render a like real translucent or refractive kind of object. Cause that,
which sounds horrible. Like if you think of it, just explained that way, I would say, oh, that's not going to look cool at all. But when you actually see it, it sort of is the way you would maybe imagine a mostly transparent invisibility cloak sort of thing to behave. So it actually looks kind of cool.
Yeah, everything sounds horrible when you... That's kind of the magic of the games thing is that, yeah, it's like a magician's trick a lot of times. When you explain how it's done, you're like, oh, that's crazy. But it works. And, you know, I'm sure that effect looked really cool because, again, you know, you're in motion at somewhere between 30 to 60 frames per second kind of thing. So that guy moving across the background probably looked pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Because you don't get to pick up. It's, I mean, you must have done this, right? When you take a screenshot of something and you can pick apart like all the flaws.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but when you're moving fast enough, whatever. Bob's your uncle. It's fine. Just keep playing.
A lot of those times where I'll see something that looks really great in a game and I'm like, oh my, you know, games like Uncharted or various games that get held up as, oh, this is the best graphically, the best game of a generation. I'll see something where it's around those edges of transparency. So like water, you know, in one of the first scenes of Uncharted or Uncharted 2, I can't remember which, there's this beautiful waterscape with the sun reflecting off the water. And it's just like, wow, there must be so much computation going into this to actually do all the reflections of the way the water is sparkling. But it's not at all. It's this flattened, you know, geometry or bitmap or video, basically, that has been done with computers that are substantially faster or offline by brilliant artists and then pasted into the game because I can't interact with it. It's just I'm looking at some water. And that's right. One of those sort of things where at first you think, oh, this would be impossible to put in a game. But it actually turns out it's really easy if you just, you know, do it Pixar style and then stick it in there.
Uncharted in particular is really great that way because they do a fantastic job of controlling the camera and, mm-hmm. and using that to like dump detail in where you happen to be looking. That there's so many of those scenes in that game where you know you can sort of see like this is set up so I can see it from this particular angle. And then I'm going to keep going and I'm going to go down into some valley and that thing's going to be hidden. And then there's more detail down in the valley that I can't see when I'm up here looking at it. And they've made it so that at almost any individual place you're standing, you can use a huge chunk of their polygon budget, which you couldn't do in a more open game, right? Like something that's sort of, like an arena style first person shooter, you know, like a Call of Duty multiplayer map or something like that. You just can't dump that much detail into any individual section of the world because there's no control over where people are looking, right? If you say, hey, we're going to put a whole bunch of polys here, you know, we're going to put 60% of our poly budget here and 60% of our poly budget there, then there's going to be some yahoo who's going to figure out the spot to stand that they can see both of those things. And now you're at 120% of your poly budget. You're done for. But mm-hmm. Uncharted does a fantastic job of controlling how you move through the levels and being, you know, really linear in practice, but just give you that sort of freedom of that you could break out of it, but you choose not to because you're following the path and organizing where they put all their details so that every shot is just gorgeous.
Right. Tomb Raider, the new Tomb Raider did a good job of that too, I find.
Yeah, it does a really good job of that as well.
As for water, one of the things that you want to avoid is if you look at like where the water touches the shore is always awful. Just because of the way that, so the way that the math on water works is that depending on the angle you're looking at, you can see into it or not, like in the Fresnel term. And so the way, like, you're on a natural shore, you can see through the water that's like sort of lapping up on the beach. The way the polys interact with water on the beach is always pretty awful. And then they try to, so you try to fix it and hide it with like a sort of like wave sort of textures around the side, but it never works well, which is why I think like a lot of times you don't see like nice beaches in games. You'll see like, it'll be like rough cliff face, right? Like water going across a cliff or, you know, like somehow contained and somehow not like a nice, normal looking pond kind of thing, because it's just really hard to sort of pull that off convincingly.
Another thing with water or any liquid, I see where you'll see a game that really pulls you into its world, like Uncharted or Tomb Raider or one of these, and you start forgetting that it's rendered and just thinking of it as the world. And then somebody will drink from a transparent glass. And then you'll be like, oh, yeah, okay, that was just a, okay.
I mean, you got to pick your challenges based on what you want to look nice. Like, water's a great example because there have been a few games over, you know, the last 5 to 7 years, I guess, that have focused on water because it's one of those, like, hair. It's one of the sort of famously hard rendering problems. And, I mean, that's one of the things that made the original Bioshock so fantastic visually, right? Like, they had a really good art style, but from a rendering complexity standpoint, like, a lot of it's very ordinary, constrained environments, right? Like, there's not a huge amount of rendering detail or crazy vistas or anything like that, but they put a huge amount of effort into the water, and that's what makes it look good. Like, it feels like you're underwater because the water rendering is so good. And that game just wouldn't have the same feel to it if you just sort of said, hey, you're underwater and we've got all these same levels and they've got the same looks, but there isn't like the puddles of water and stuff seeping in and like the real feel that it's a wet environment.
Yeah, they did a really, really good job on that. One of the it's those sort of little touches that you, I think people don't necessarily remark on them, but you do sort of take away as sort of the whole feel of it. Like, one of the first ones that, going back to Tomb Raider, when they made Lara Croft's ponytail sway with, you know, doing the inverse kinematics thing, that was really cool. It was the kind of, I mean, this is years and years and years ago, but it was the kind of touch that sort of made it look like a realistic and visceral and kinetic sort of character rather than just being sort of an avatar that you're driving around the world.
And those things drive the character design a lot, because prior to that, you would generally try and make it so characters have close cropped hair, because if they have this big mound of curls that should bounce around, like Merida from Brave or something, it would look insanely bad.
Right. So you just avoid it. I mean, and that's a lot of the art of making games is knowing, you know, where to put your poly budget or where to put your affiliate budget, or just know which problems you can't solve or just avoid entirely. I think, you know, a lot of that comes from experience, and a lot of it comes from, it's often like an artist being like, well, how come I can't make her hair bounce around?
Well, I'm sure that the artists drive a lot of that, right? Like, you do your architecture and your design for the game technically, and then you get 3/4 of the way through, and then an artist or a director or someone is like, all right, now we're going to have someone, a really pivotal moment, we're going to do this super close-up shot, and then they're going to drink the poison from the vial. Right. And then, then someone's like, excuse me, we don't have, we're not set up to do that.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's the way you get inventive, is you sort of paint yourself into a corner and you got to try to figure your way out.
Yeah. And then the vial becomes wooden.
Yes.
another one of my favorite, sort of, you know, hacks, things that you would think you would never ship, but someone did, and it actually ended up working out for the best. You guys are probably familiar with the fast inverse square root.
Yep.
Yep.
So this, for people who haven't heard the story, this is something that came out in the code for, I believe it's Quake 3.
Pretty sure it's Quake 3.
Yeah.
Quake also, 3 got, it's not worth doing anymore, by the way.
But, oh, that's good to know. Yeah. I'll take that out of Party Monster. So in Quake 3, someone open sourced the code, I guess. It's open sourced the code, and people were looking through it, and there is a function that did inverse square root, which is important for doing shadows and things like this. There was this little piece of math that was totally unexplained, and it just said, like, you know, evil hack WTF, yeah. Where they took a floating point number, treated it as if it was an integer, yeah. and then just subtracted it from some totally arbitrary number that had no explanation, 5F37, blah, 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 blah. And then they just returned the answer. And yes. It's fast.
It's bananas. I'm still not. I've read the description of how that works, and I still don't understand it.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. Like, we think we used it for a while in some of the games, but we just, like, copy and pasted that code and, like, didn't even try to understand it. We're just like, yep, this is a square root. We tested it. It's faster. We'll keep using it. But no, I don't know why that does what it does.
Yeah, and isn't it like an order of magnitude faster and like 98% is accurate or something like that? So it's sort of for science, it would be inappropriate, but for a game, it's golden.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's definitely one of those things that, like, again, like we were saying earlier, you get to cheat in games a lot. And that's one of the ones that you get to cheat. It's, you know, close enough for a shadow. That's fine. We used to always, I don't know if you guys did this at Radical, but maybe this was, I don't know. I don't know if this still made sense at the time, but, lookup tables for sine and cosine.
Oh yeah. We definitely did those in the, like, PlayStation 1 era games. I think even for, I don't know if we use them for sine and cos for, like, PlayStation 2 era games. We still use some lookup tables for a few crazy things, but definitely we use them for sine and cos. Like, on that era of hardware, like, floating point operations were just brutal, like, way slower than you can imagine, like, dozens or hundreds of times slower than integer operations. So anything like that that you could sort of only do in floating point, you just had to figure out a way not to do it.
Right.
But this is such a quintessential, if you're a software engineer and you're used to, okay, we want to make our code clean and concise, and we don't want to repeat ourselves, and we don't want to have extra sources of potential bugs. The idea of pre-calculating sine and cosine, which is something that you can calculate really fast, like, you know, way less, like 0.001 of a second or something like this to calculate. So the idea of pre-calculating that and storing it and then potentially having bugs with your pre-calculated values or fetching them or whatever is completely insane, except when it's not.
Right. Well, you know, it's all about cheating. Quake, I think it was Quake, Doom, maybe. The direction the character went in with, like, the movement vector was represented by 8 bits. It was a byte.
We did that for surface normals at Radical a lot. We had what we totally called the normal porcupine. So we predefined a set of, I think it was 256 normals. So we just generate, like, you know, here's randomly distribute points on the surface of a sphere, 256 of them. Those are our surface normals. And then we just store the surface normals for points as the 1 8-bit value rather than as 3 floating point, and then, like, decompress them basically in the vertex transformation code so that you didn't have to store, like, 3 floats as a surface normal for everything. I think even fairly late into things, like, even way after that was all done in hardware and we didn't have to worry about the performance of doing the normals and we were, like, decompressing them in the vertex buffers, I think we still kept using those, though maybe we went up to 16 bits instead of 8 bits at that point, for load performance reasons.
Right,
because then we can store, like, I mean, the thing about surface normals that makes them easy to compress, which is that you don't have to be very accurate to get really good lighting on something, particularly if, you know, unless you've got like lots of really small polygons close together where you can see like quantization in the lighting. When you're streaming an enormous world, like saving, you know, what would that work out to, like 780 bytes per vertex in the world is like a pretty big deal.
Yeah, that's huge. And if you can, I mean, you don't have to ship it over the bus either, right? Every time you, like whenever you're moving that data around, a lot of the time you end up with an unfortunate mem copy at some time, you know, you got to move a model around or you got to sort of either ship it to the card, although that's less of an issue on consoles. And whatever memory you can save just means like that more bandwidth is going towards, you know, driving the game rather than, you know, being overly precious about how the surface is lit.
Well, the loading time thing is an interesting point, because anything in a game that you can render at 60 frames a second, any extra horsepower you have is nice because, you know, maybe then something happens, additional enemies come on screen or there's an explosion or something. And so it's nice to have the overhead. But anything that affects loading time, faster is always better, like kind of infinitely. Like if you can get the game started in 5 seconds instead of 10, that's better. If you can get it started in 2.5, that's better. If you can get started in 1, that's better. And so hacks that you might think, oh, well, you know, now we have 60 frames a second, so maybe we don't have to worry about this. But making the game load slower is always going to be worse.
Well, and also load time has gotten slower, or not gotten slower. It has gotten fast slower than other things have gotten fast, right? That you have this sort of hierarchy of things, you know, of how fast you can access certain things. It's like, okay, stuff in registers takes one cycle, and stuff in L1 cache takes one cycle, and stuff in L2 cache takes like 15 cycles, and stuff in main memory takes like 300 cycles, and stuff on disk takes like 15,000 cycles. And the performance increase is always at the like closer to the execution unit side of things, right? Like that processors have gotten a lot faster and main memory buses have gotten a little bit faster. And you look at like any modern console, right? Like you look at like the PS4 or the Xbox One, even them being like only a modest increase over the previous generation compared to like, you know, between PlayStation 2 and PlayStation 3 was like 50 times faster. Mm-hmm. And between PlayStation 3 and PlayStation 4 is like only 10 times faster, something like that. Like, I don't know if those are the exact numbers, but it's somewhere in that order of magnitude. But the like disc on the PlayStation 4 is probably not even 2x faster than the one on the PlayStation 3.
Is the disc, like the spinning, like we still literally in 2014, and therefore because game consoles last like 7 years, then until like 2021, we still have a physical spinning piece of plastic, which sounds ridiculous, that you have to read the data from if you haven't installed it to the...
Yeah, those are the worst.
Well, I think you don't on the Xbox One. I think on the Xbox One, because they were originally planning it to be download only, it's all hard drive installs. So they got a nice speed up in load time by saying you can count on that you're reading off the hard drive rather than the disk. I don't think the PlayStation 4 has that guarantee. I think you can install, but you're not necessarily guaranteed that you're able to install.
Yeah, metaphorically, your data is getting further and further away, though. Like, your chip can chomp it way faster than it can get, you know, from your medium, even whether it be a hard drive or a spinning disk. It's night and day different. Did a bunch of work on the PSP, the original one, which had a UMD, and that was a huge pain in the ass. it was ridiculous. So it had a 2-second seek time from the front of the disc to the back of the disc.
Just to move the motor of the lens from side, edge to edge. Basically.
Exactly, yeah. And it was, I forget what they called it, but it was basically, it was double-sided, metaphorically speaking at least, in that you would have two tracks. So, and my job was to stream music off it. And that was a nightmare because it didn't have a lot of memory either. And it had a 2-second seek time. So we had to jump through amazing hoops in order to sort of like anticipate when we were going to need to do the jump like 2 seconds ahead of time. That doesn't sound like much in software, but 2 seconds of game time is like a long time.
Yeah, and you need to have 2 seconds of, well, more than 2 seconds probably, music preloaded.
Yeah.
It's like working off a tape, but in a real-time system.
Exactly, yeah. It was bananas trying to manage that.
I only recently learned that like one of the steps of optimizing game performance, at least in previous generations, maybe not as much now on the Xbox One or whatever, is laying the data out onto the optical disc in an optimal way. And a game that might perform really fine and, you know, stream things well, especially like these open world games where you're running around and buildings are getting loaded in, and then it gets laid out slightly differently on the disc so that it needs to move the motor some more, and then the game's dropping frames and things are popping in and it's a disaster.
That's exactly what we had to do for to get the audio performing.
We cut that extremely close for Prototype. I didn't work on the world streaming, so I don't know exactly how close, but I know that if you laid the disc out wrong, you could outrun the world streaming. Like that if you went like sideways across Manhattan as opposed to up and down, because up and down, like the cells were rectangular and sort of oriented along the up and down direction. And so if you ran sideways and you had like a full disk seek time between every cell load, you'd outrun the world. Like the character could run faster than the world could stream. But if you laid it out correctly, you'd be fine. You can also, like, if you scratch the disk, you'll be able to outrun the world on Prototype.
So your superhero is not limited by the laws of physics, but he's limited by the laws of how fast can you load data off of.
Yeah, and I think I'm not 100% sure about this, but I think there might have even been like a fight about that between the designers and the tech guys at some point, that they like wanted to increase the speed of the character, and they were like, no, we can't. I heard that like second or third hand, so I might be mangling that story, but I seem to recall that at one point, like there was some they wanted to do something and they just couldn't, because maybe it was the helicopters in Prototype 2 or something like that. I don't remember the exact details.
I'd believe that for sure. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, you get the gameplay sort of prototype. Not prototype, but whatever. You know, you get your
You have no idea how much of a pain in the ass working on a game named Prototype was. Like, I seriously wanted to strangle the people that came up with that every single day.
It's a cool name. It just makes it hard to talk about it.
I didn't believe, Nigel, that it wasn't just, like, you know how you make a code name for something? You're like, yeah, we're going to call it, you know, Microsoft Bob as just the code name, and then it actually ends up shipping with that, and then it just starts sounding good because you hear it so much, and then you say, oh, yeah, let's just keep it called that. I was convinced that Prototype was just, oh, it didn't have a name. It didn't have a code name. So it was just the prototype of the game. And then but apparently it actually had a different code name. And then they changed it to Prototype, which I was quite impressed with.
What was the code name?
I don't remember.
Well, there you go. So you picked the right name.
Yeah. It got named Prototype fairly early in development. Oh, the team did have a name. Like, we didn't usually give at Radical projects individual code names, but each game team had like a team name that you were theoretically supposed to use to refer to the game team when out in public, if the game hadn't been announced. So you could talk about, like, you know, you could go out to lunch and talk about, like, hey, this is what so-and-so on the Prototype team is going, but you don't have to say the word Prototype if it hasn't been announced. So the code name for the Prototype team was Hair Club.
Right.
and so that might have been what you were thinking of, but I don't think the game ever actually had a separate code name. I think it was always called Prototype.
Hair Club is a terrible code name, which is what makes it such a good code name, because no one would get so used to calling it Hair Club that they'd be like, you know what, this is a great AAA game title, Hair Club.
Right. They should just call the next iPhone Hair Club.
Well, Apple's done that. Like the big cat names were just internal code names that leaked out through the marketing department.
Or right? Purple for the iPhone, right?
Yeah.
That was the code name for the iPhone project in its very early days. Like from what I understand, that was like the code name when they had two versions of the iPhone software. Like they had the one that like Scott Forstall and that team were working on with Objective-C, and then they had like the Tony Fadell iPod on steroids one. And I don't know what the code name of the I put on steroids one was, but I, from what I understand, the code name on the iPhone, you know, that we know now was purple, and you can still see that in stack traces.
Yeah,
sometimes.
It's still in the stack
traces. Like some of those very fundamental, like kernel level functions, you'll see purple in there.
Yeah, initially. Like the event dispatch stuff has like broken in a lot. Yeah.
That was all, that's all the, like in radar and stuff, those internal tools are still called purple, or at least they were in the iPad days. It's all just called purple.
You know what though? That's, it's less surprising when you figure it was like P1 or P2. I mean, what are you going to call it? It's like P for phone, right? So it's kind of, anyway, I don't know. Off topic.
Should we take a sponsor?
Sure.
Yeah.
So this episode is brought to you by Van Coco. Van Coco is a free speaker series that we run here in Vancouver, building apps for iOS and the Mac. We invite guests from around the world, as well as local talent, to give awesome talks, and then we reward them with beer or other beverages as they prefer. So if you'll be in Vancouver sometime this year and be interested in giving a talk or dropping in on one of our meetups, get in touch at www.vancoco.com.
I didn't know you guys did that. That's great.
Yeah, we were actually inspired by Coco Heads Montreal. And we'd seen how well that seemed to be turning out, and you developed a community around that. And so, like, why don't we have that equivalent in Vancouver? So we took a little bit of a spin on it and trying to bring people from out of town. And Guy, you'll be joining us next week, right?
Sure.
Fly across the country.
Fly out all the way out there, yeah. Special guest.
Yeah, it'd be perfect. So do you either of you, Guy, you said you whipped up a couple hacks that you – like that you mentioned one or two.
Yeah, of them. I'm trying to think them now. One of the ones I liked, I mean, a lot of this is just old school. Maybe it's just me reminiscing. We did, one of the first games I worked on was an Age of Sail simulator. So, you know, Battle of Trafalgar and tall ships and that kind of thing. And it was very old in that, like, it was predated sort of 3D GPUs. And it was all rendered sort of the same way that Wolfenstein 3D was rendered, in that we'd have a collection of bitmaps from different angles and then scale them. And it was 256 colors, too. So you had a color palette rather than being 16-bit or 32-bit color. You would have an index, and that index would look into a color palette. So, you know, whatever. Integer 10 would be a green, and 15 was white, or, you know, so on and so forth. And I got it in my head that, like, so when the cannons fired, big white clouds came out, and it annoyed me because I wanted the smoke to be transparent. And transparency in a palette color system is kind of a pain in the ass to pull off. But I
managed. That doesn't stop you.
No, of course not. That just makes you mad, and then you go figure out how to do it. So I did it with a lookup table, because you know, you could figure out, okay, white looked up against this color, the pixel behind it would be roughly this other color for the transparent thing, and it worked pretty well. Except then I remembered that the way we simulated day and night was we changed the color palette over time. So like a section of the palette would be you know, changing over time, so they would go darker. Anything in the sky would basically go towards black, like it for night missions. So I ended up having to have my transparency lookup palette also be keyed on time. So there was this giant lookup palette for colors that, like,
for every, if there's like eight graduations in between day and night, then there's eight lookup tables for transparency.
Exactly. Yeah. And it would pick the right one and it picked the right thing. This is not rocket science, but it is it's just, looking back on it now, it amuses me how much work and worry goes into making seemingly simple effects, you know?
But so much of it is really brute force, right? It's, how can we do this in a way, like, doing it in a simple way is too slow.
Right.
So how can we brute force in a way, either by doing work up front or just like hammering our figurative head against the problem?
Yeah, it's not, I mean, brute force just means like throwing compute power at it, I guess. So not really that. It's more cheating. Like, how do we cheat? What's the, you know, how do we James T. Kirk this into actually making sense and then working in some kind of reasonable approximation of what somebody would expect?
The first time I implemented a physics engine in a game, we're doing for one of my university graphics classes, we're doing a pinball machine. And there was no instructions in the class about how to do anything other than OpenGL. So we're just doing the OpenGL, I'm doing the pinball or whatever. And I get to the point where, okay, well, I want the flappers to actually collide with the pinball mm-hmm. and make it fly. So I just say, okay, well, for now, I'll just try to move the pinball. And if it intersects with the flapper, I'll move it back out again. Mm-hmm. And then I'll figure out later how you actually do physics in games, because that's obviously stupid and games would not actually do that.
Jokes on you.
Unfortunately, jokes on me, and that's actually how. Or at least, you know, that was the state of the art last I heard, was just keep moving the thing until you move it into another thing, and then take it just barely out of that thing, and then, yeah.
Well, solving for that kind of thing is pretty, it, you know, can be computationally pretty expensive. And because the other thing is, so the thing to remember is that if your ball is moving fast, it can overstep the paddle. Right.
That definitely happened.
Yeah.
When it got too fast, it would just fly through the paddle because...
Right. A T0 that has not connected yet. A T1, it is past the paddle. And if you're just doing a naive sort of test thing, then you just totally miss it, right? So you kind of need to take those iterative steps or get cleverer.
Well, what I did is I made it so that the ball actually gets simulated multiple times per clock second as a horrible hack, that it was temporary mm-hmm. until I found out.
Jokes on you. I was just about to interrupt you and tell the story of exactly how we did that on Simpsons Hit and Run, which was a crazy, like, run it multiple times per frame hack.
Yeah. So, was Simpsons Hit and Run the one where one of the testers tried to break it by...
Yes. Yeah, so... So Simpsons Hit and Run's a driving game. It was an open world driving game. The frame rate for it was never that great. And we had a slightly twitchy physics system because this was like way before like middleware physics systems were a big thing. Like, you know, if anyone's making a game now, like even if they're like, no, we want to do our own engine. We want to do everything. We don't want to license something. I'd be like, no, you have to license at least a physics engine. Like, yeah. Like not doing that is nuts. But at this point, like there weren't a whole bunch of third party out there. So we'd had our own for a couple of games that we were using. It was a little twitchier than it needed to be. And we just had these huge amounts of problems maintaining stability, and particularly like balancing, maintaining stability and frame rate. So we do like
stability, not in a crashy way, but in the actual, like the,
yeah. And like the stability of the simulation way,
comes
right?
To
that
rest,
like, but, you know, two cars will run into each other and the physics is running too slow. And they'll get so far in that the physics system will just freak out and like throw one of them up into the air at 800 miles an hour or something like that kind of stuff. So, you know, if we ran the physics at like regular frame rate, we get those kind of errors all the time, particularly if the simulation rate drops. So we'd say like, okay, well, we're going to run physics multiple times a frame, but that would cause these huge performance problems, because what would happen is the frame rate would drop a little bit enough that we sort of said, okay, well, now we've got to run the physics multiple times in order to catch up, but that just makes it slower, right? Like now we're running physics twice every frame, and so it gets slower, and we get into these like death spiral situations where you could do things like one of our testers like purposely broke the game by like collecting every dynamic object in the world and pushing them all into a big pile in the center of the level, and
what a jerk.
And so we had to come up with these like this like crazy set of rules of like, okay, we want to try and do like frame, you know, the simulation of the physics at I don't even remember what the exact numbers were. We want to try and simulate it at 50 frames a second. So if you're running at 30 frames a second, like we'll let that slide, but if it drops down to 20 frames a second, then we have to do two simulations per, and we had like this complicated dampening logic of like, if it just goes down, like if the frame rate drops below our threshold for like one frame or two frames, that's fine. But once we've got three consecutive frames in a row where our simulation has dropped enough, we'll flip over into two update per simulation mode. And if it ever gets slow enough that we need three updates per simulation, then we'll actually start like dialing down the real speed of the simulation, that like everything would go into slow-mo at that point. So when you got the malicious tester like piling everything in the middle of the level, then it would just be like the game was running at 5 frames a second and everything was in super slow-mo. So it looked crummy, but it still kind of held together. And yeah, I mean, that's...
And this big pile of cars and benches and lampposts is just vibrating at like 10 frames a second. Oh, man. There's actually quite a few bugs. I mean, that idea of letting things collide or intersect and then popping them out again has led to exploits in various games. Like in one of the Grand Theft Auto games, I think it might have been San Andreas, you could get a semi-trailer and hook it up to a trailer, or semi-truck and hook it up to a trailer. And then if you sort of like swerved in such a way that the trailer and the truck would intersect and then the physics engine would cause them to pop out of one another, you could use it to accelerate yourself like hundreds of times faster than a car would normally go and then just launch off into space or whatever. It was quite fantastic, just as a quirk of the way that that physics simulation works.
Yeah, I mean, physics bugs, like almost always that's the behavior of them, is something goes launching off at some incredible speed.
Funny thing is, a lot of times the developers don't even know what the hell's going on. It's a simulation, right? So anything, like, stuff can happen and you don't necessarily anticipate it. I guess,
yeah, it's hard to catch all that stuff in testing, for sure. Like, there's so many of those weird edge cases that as soon as you start simulating things, you're just leaving the door open for like behavior that no one ever imagined. And if you don't happen to have someone that says, hey, I wonder what happens if, of the like, you know, few dozen to few hundred people that have access to the game during development, like, you know, as soon as millions of people have access to that game, it's going to occur to someone to say, hey, I wonder what happens if, and then you're screwed.
Yeah. A good...
It's amazing to me how much of that stuff is mitigated, not by fixing the code, but by getting the level designers to brute force or just like slug through and mark these areas as like, okay, when in doubt, don't push the area over here. Don't put your characters over here. Put the characters on the road instead of into this like junkyard or something.
One of the things we did on Hit and Run for physics stuff is we had a pretty complicated set of flags to determine which objects could interact. So this was partially for optimization purposes, but partially to help with cutting back on some of those pathological situations where we'd say like, okay, you know, these objects are static and so they can't interact with each other. And these objects are like totally superfluous, so we'll let them, you know, bounce off static objects, but just let them go through any other dynamic objects so that you can't do things like set up these crazy situations with them and stuff like that. Like that, you know, that's the sort of thing that you often end up doing to hack around that, is just come up with some rules of stuff that you're just not going to allow to interact to stop from the pathological situations developing.
Well, that's another one of sort of the tricks of games, is that it's not a world that you're simulating. There's bits that you can and can't interact with, and there's like a lot of tricks that sort of get played where you as a player hopefully never notice the limitations, but you know, the game designer and programmer has had to sort of delineate all kinds of stuff and made a bunch of decisions that, you know, hopefully the player doesn't see, but ultimately result in the game being playable rather than just, you know, a nice simulation that runs at like, you know, 1 hertz.
People really underestimate the pain that level designers have to go through in order to limit you from doing things that the game just can't handle you doing without you feeling like you're being limited. Like all these levels, and especially in the modern games that are kind of linear, like you just kind of have to go along this path and there's not really any other ways that you can go, and coming up with excuses, like especially when you go into fairly open areas, like let's say you go to a farm, right? Realistically, in a farm you should be able to wander for kilometers in any direction Whereas practically, like, even if you're the Hulk and you walk up to a fence, you just can't jump over that fence. And so whether you make it a really tall fence or there's a barbed wire on the fence or something, you have to not be able to go for miles and miles off in, you know, the wrong direction. And as a level designer, that's, you know, hard. That's why so many of our levels are just like in an underground bunker of a little guy.
Yeah, and you have to get good at not making people feel like the walls are there, right? Like, it's not just a matter of limiting choice, but making it feel like the limits and choice are reasonable or pushing you along. Like, I mean, Call of Duty is the best example of that in a modern game. Of it's so ridiculously linear and ridiculously scripted, but they do a really fantastic job of, like, keeping the pressure on and keeping the excitement up and making you feel like you're just kind of, well, I got to do something. This seems like the most obvious thing to do. I'm going to do it. And that was in fact the only thing that you could possibly do. And if you decided to do anything else, you would have run into an invisible wall. And, like, you know, you can criticize that style of gameplay if you're someone who likes more like open, flexible experiences, but I don't think you can criticize the skill with which the Call of Duty guys do it.
they did a remarkably good job. And it's true, like, these open world games are also, I mean, there's a bunch of tricks that you guys must have played in terms of level design and, you know, encouraging. A lot of the times it's like basically you want to encourage the player to do what you want them to do.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's, you know, it's a trick. That's
a huge amount of that is lighting. Like, if you just make a area, someone gets dropped in a cave or any environment, and for whatever reason, either you come up with an excuse for there to be bright light in one direction, or you just literally put lights on the wall, or it's just arbitrary and there isn't even actually any real good excuse why it's brightly lit down there, but people will go to the light. It's just natural. They'll look around. And also something that's really different in sort of, I've been playing a few retro games that are 5 or 10 years old, even games like Ico and Shadow of the Colossus that are not old, but they're sort of from previous era of game design, where you'll fall, let's say you fall down a hole and you collapse in a heap and then you stand up. Previously, you would just stand up wherever you stood up, whereas now you'll stand up and then your character will take a step to the left and face where they're supposed to go. That's what like a new game would do. And it's a very subtle distinction, but nowadays you can kind of just walk forward and then you'll sometimes hit a wall and you'll need to turn. Whereas it used to be that you could easily have landed and be facing the opposite direction and see something interesting over there, and it's just a complete waste of time.
Yeah, like Ico or Eco, I think is maybe actually how that's supposed to be pronounced. I've never been 100% clear on that. I'm playing it right now, actually. I played through about half of it back when I had a PS2, and then I had like a borrowed copy I had to return and never finished it, and so I picked up the Ico Shadows of the Colossus collection. I've been playing it, and it's kind of remarkable how willing that game is to just give you like no clue of what you're supposed to do compared to a modern game, that it'll just be like, yep, you're in this room, go nuts. Yeah. Whereas any modern game would be very much like, no, I've got to show you at least where you want to go. Right. Like, even if they say, no, we're going to make it challenging and you need to figure out how to get there, modern game design is much better about hinting you like what you want to achieve than games even from that era, which, you know, that's only like a 10, maybe a little more than 10-year-old game, I think.
Yeah, about that. I mean, one thing I've noticed too is sort of an uptick in, I don't know what to call it, but so, in the Batman games, you've got the detective mode. Tomb Raider does the same thing. I forget what they call it there. But, you know, basically the
survival instinct.
Yeah, something like that. But basically it's like you hit a button and it shows you what you can interact with. And that's a nifty way of sort of accomplishing what we're talking about, which is basically, you know, point the user towards success effectively.
And so many games are picking that up now because you can make it easy. It's basically like almost a help button.
Right.
Because if people are just flowing through the game and they're in the zone and they're just going to the next thing, and the level design is working for them, you don't need to break the reality of the game in order to be like, alert, alert, you can hook onto this one piece of wood. But if they do need it and they start to get stuck, then they just press a button and then they're good to go.
Right. It's a little bit weird in that I don't know why you wouldn't just play Batman in detective mode the entire time. Besides the fact that the one weird and arbitrary thing that they do is they take away the compass HUD, which is weird because he's looking through a computer and they actually take away the compass. I don't, it doesn't make sense. But for all practical purposes, it just gives you more information, tells you how to play the game better. The only reason you don't is because it just looks pretty awesome with it off.
I definitely found myself with playing the Batman games, like occasionally just leaving it in detective mode accidentally, like not even thinking about it, of like, not like, oh, I'm going to put it in detective mode because it's easier to play the game with, but just like, I need detective mode for some section. And then
and then
I'd be like, oh wait, I've been playing the game for like 5 minutes after I finish that section where I need to figure out what I need to do, and I'm still in detective mode. Yeah, like Tomb Raider, the equivalent mode in Tomb Raider, I think is more fragile than that, if I remember correctly.
As soon
like
as you move, you start it goes
moving.
Away. Yeah. Which is that's what I wanted in Batman. Because I've played them all recently. I just got a Mac Pro, so of course, what am I doing? I'm playing video games on it. I call the video games I missed, basically. I've had that exact thing. Like in Batman, there's some missions where you look for a telephone that's ringing, and it's basically you click the detective mode and you see where the phone is, and then you've got to run across the city. And more than once, I've found myself like 20 minutes later, I'm like, oh yeah, everything's blue. Like I'm totally in detective mode. Tomb Raider does it great though, because as soon as you move, it washes out. Like you can't move around the environment while being in whatever detective mode, survival instinct.
Yeah, and you can do better at hinting people getting out of it. Like Batman, it's less different visually, so it's easier to just forget about. Where something like Assassin's Creed, they do that with the eagle vision, but it's very different visually, and it's only in specific missions that you've got to like track someone that it even has any effect at all. So it's, you know, they encourage you pretty strongly to get out of it when you're done, whereas Batman doesn't. Like you can put it on and leave it on, and the game's still totally playable. And
games also make them run out. Like in Deus Ex, they have a see the bad guys through walls, and that's really useful in a stealth game. But you get however many, it uses up your energy resources, which is a pretty good trade off.
Yeah, I think Dishonored does that too, doesn't it? Like it's got that same like track bad guys through walls mode, and it's tied into like the rest of the, I don't remember what they call the like mana, but basically you've got the reserve of energy you can use your powers from, and all of those burn it to some degree. It sounds like the new Thief game is the same way, that there's some limit on how much you can use the focus ability, which is their equivalent, like see the gameplay objects mode.
I was just going to say, any last hacks you guys want to mention or bring up before we call it a show?
Well, I don't know how geeky we want to go, but a couple of mine that I had on my list of stuff to maybe mention were also like super old school ones. I think the early days, not even like the really early days of the game industry, but like particularly pre-hardware acceleration, when you were still doing software rendering of stuff, there were just so many like crazy hacks that you needed to do. The absolute worst one I think that I was ever personally involved in was doing the inner loop of the software texture mapper that we used for doing 3D rendering. I was the main maintainer of that at Radical for a couple of years, back when I first started there. And so we had I think we got our, you know, just sort of on our own, we'd gotten our inner loop down to like 12 or 13 CPU cycles per pixel, which is pretty good. Very but good. Then we'd heard that Quake had one that was 5 cycles, and we're like, oh, well, this is completely useless. So we figured out what they were doing, and we couldn't do exactly the same thing they did, but But you know, using the same, some of the same tricks that they were doing, we managed to get it down like a couple of cycles down to like 10 cycles or something like that. And then I was looking through the code. I'm like, there's gotta be something else in here. Like there's gotta be some other thing. And I noticed that one of the things that, that we couldn't sort of exploit directly from the Quake code, but one thing that they were doing that was different than us is they fit everything in a register, whereas we had to store a couple of things still in memory locations because we didn't have enough general purpose registers, right? This is
Intel's,
this is like PC, a PC game, right? Yeah. So x86, you've got your four general purpose registers, you know, EAX through EDX. And we were already using ESI and EDI, which are like the indexing registers and the ones you're supposed to use to like construct memory addresses. We're already using them as general purpose registers. So you get six registers that way, but we still had like two pieces of data that we needed to keep in memory. And so we're like, well, is there anything else we can do? Like, could we, you know, keep like two things in one register by just keeping two 16-bit values? And what we ended up doing was we ended up using EBP and ESP as our other two registers.
You can't do that.
Which, I mean, anyone who's familiar with x86 assembly is going to immediately have that reaction. Like, whoa, you can't do that. Yeah, but it turns out you can.
I mean, so long as you restore them, I guess you're okay. But wow.
Yeah, if you store ESP and EBP, like EBP is actually pretty easy to,
you can
to use. But ESP, like you have to store it to a known memory location, right? There's nowhere like on the stack.
Or just, so that's the stack pointer, which
that's the stack pointer. Yeah. So
this that's is the part of the computer that figures out what code to use next, and you're using and abusing it for
purposes. It's not what figures out what code to use next. That would be like the program counter, which you really couldn't possibly use as a register. ESP keeps a pointer to what the current stack frame is, so it's got like all of your local variables inside a function call and your return address for your function,
which is the big one.
Which that's the one that turns out to be the problematic one from the point of view of doing this. So you store ESP to somewhere else when you start your inner loop, and then you just use EBP and ESP as general purpose registers, and that's great, and it all runs fine, except you lose the ability to use the debugger because now hitting pause in the debugger will crash the debugger because it expects to have stack ESP like available in order to unwind the stack to display the stack trace. So you couldn't debug code using like Visual Studio, which is what we're using at the time as our development environment. Like as soon as you broke into the, inner loop, you would crash the CPU. But with that optimization, we managed to get down to 8 cycles per pixel. So within
impressive.
Within like 30% of the Quake 1 like minimum software texture mapper.
That's
which
pretty,
we were pretty happy about that.
That's great. Yeah. I don't know what kind of audience you have, but texture mapping, that's a bunch of divides and a whole bunch of other stuff going on. So that it's getting it down to 8 cycles. That's pretty impressive.
Well, this was 8 cycles for the affine portion.
Okay.
If you're going to do perspective correct texture mapping, this is another good example of like a hacky optimization is we did our perspective divide, I think every like 16 pixels or something like that.
Interpolated it?
So we do the perspective divide and then run the inner loop for 16 pixels and then do another perspective divide. And that gave you a good enough look and was, you know, 10 times faster than doing the perspective divide on every pixel.
Especially at those kind of resolutions too, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting that you ask Guy what kind of audience we have because
we don't know.
You know, this is the fourth show. We don't know yet. We're going to start releasing them, this week or next week. But we'll definitely find out when we air this show how many non-programmers were listening and then, you know,
I think when you start throwing out ESP and EBP, people are going to be, you need to know your stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I think in theory, it's like trying to get it. So even if, as long as you're interested in programming in theory, you could get some entertainment out of it, which I think we succeeded at, even if you don't know it. I mean, I don't know what ESP, I've never had to write any code that directly touches those.
Yeah, don't.
But I know it's bad and that you shouldn't, so.
Yeah, don't do that anymore. Yeah. There's actually, speaking of the stack pointer, there's another one. This might be apocryphal. This isn't something that I encountered directly. It's like I heard it second or third hand. But supposedly on like the old Z80s, so this would be the processor that was in like the Commodore 64 and like, you know, the Timex Sinclair machines and stuff like that, writing, like storing a register to the stack pointer was like one cycle, but storing a register just to memory with like a store was two cycles. So you'd get situations where people would do sort of the opposite bit of craziness with the stack pointer, where they use the stack pointer to just do general purpose stores by like saying, all right, we're just going to point the stack pointer at this piece of memory that we want to like render a bitmap to, and then render it by loading the values and then pushing them on the stack rather than loading them and storing them because it was faster.
That's crazy.
That one I tried actually a little bit before we started recording to confirm that, because it's when I'd heard like years and years ago, and always just sort of like, oh yeah, that's interesting. And I'm like, well, I'm gonna tell this on the air. I better check my work. And I couldn't find any confirmation that this was true. So maybe it's just one of those like programmer urban legends, but it's certainly something that I will say this. Yeah. If it is true that a stack pointer store was one cycle versus two cycles for a general purpose store, I can pretty much guarantee that someone used it in that way at some point, right? Like the only thing that could be wrong is it could be that Z80s don't actually operate like that, that it's actually just, you know, just one cycle or two cycles for both of those stores. But if it's different, someone definitely used that.
Somebody abused it for sure.
One of those like Commodore 64 or ZX80 games.
If you can hack it, they will come.
Oh, yeah. That's like one of those things is like, if you're designing processors and that happens, just slow it down arbitrarily, because you're encouraging really bad practices by doing that.
Well, a lot of those, like if you hear the stories of how people got things working on the early, you know, on the Ataris and, you know, on the original, the Apple II in these machines or the original Mac, often there's stories of the hardware accidentally supported this crazy hack, and because of that, we could actually make compelling software that would never have been possible if it worked the way it was designed.
Yeah, happy accidents.
Happy accidents.
Yep.
All right, so let's call it there. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Guy for joining us.
Pleasure.
Check out the show notes or subscribe at www.upup.fm or follow us on Twitter, UpUpShow. See you next week.
Have you heard this thing about the guy who's trying to get to like the death zone in Minecraft?
There's a death zone?
Yeah. So Minecraft, theoretically, the world is infinite. But in practice, if you get far enough away from the origin, which is where you spawn,
coordinates of what floats or something, and you can
The math starts to break down. And like this is something that I've encountered before. We had that problem with Simpsons Hit and Run, because the all the interiors were stored like way off at the edge of the world, and so the animation system used like all these hacky like 16-bit fixed point values and stuff like that, and the animation system would just start breaking down where they'd stored the interiors. So Minecraft, obviously it's not close enough that you can get to it easily, but people have been there in like hacked fly mode and stuff like that, but some guy's actually like recording like a YouTube series of him just trying to walk there.
So this is the consequence of years. Computers obviously, maybe not obviously, use approximations of floating bit numbers of decimal numbers. They use approximations, and he's going so far from the beginning of the world that that approximation breaks down and cannot accurately represent the universe anymore, basically.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or, well, because the further away you go, the less accurate the math becomes. We had that in a game at one of my old companies called Orb, and it was like a spaceship game, similar to Homeworld, actually, and around the same time. And for whatever reason, I don't know why, but the engine guys had, I think it was like my first 3D engine kind of style stuff. All of the positions of like the turrets and stuff on the ships were expressed in floats, but in global coordinates. So as you flew away from the center of the map, your turrets would just start flipping out, like they would be rotating everywhere because they didn't have stable math behind them because the floats were all jammed up.
Right, and they were getting sort of rounded to sane values, but that the ship is moving smoothly and they're not.
Yeah, just everything would just jump around. You know, you got floats are, don't do any finance in floats.
It's something that you wouldn't think that an end user would ever become aware of, these limits in what computers use to store integers and floating point numbers. But one of the games I was playing when I was a kid was this like old DOS version of Monopoly. And I found, for whatever reason, that if you you could give people money, it would let you do that. I don't really know why. But you could give other people as much money as you wanted. But if you gave someone enough money that they had more than $65,000, then suddenly, or $32,000, okay. They suddenly had negative $32,000.
It's one way to win.
Because it would overflow. Yeah. They were using a signed variable. And so once I discovered this, of course, I played a game of Monopoly with my brother, and I'm like, hey, do you want $99,999? And he's like, of course I do. And so I did that a couple times until it overflowed, and he was negative thousands, tens of thousands of debt, and then I passed the turn to him, and he instantly lost. So
nice.
So I didn't understand why.
Kind of a
why.
Jerky brother.
Well, he was my younger brother. That's kind of what you're
okay, that's fair. Yeah.
And then I got bit that by that. Actually, he managed to get me back because maybe 5 or 10 years later, I made a game that was like a war game, and he managed to create some circumstance where he was so negative in debt that it caused an overflow and then had positive amounts of money and then was able to completely obliterate and destroy the balance of the game. And I was like, yeah, you owed me on that one. I think you got me back.
So interestingly, the technique that we couldn't use that the Quake texture mapper exploited in order to get it down to 5 cycles was doing a like underflowing subtract. They use the subtract with borrow instruction as like their main UV coordinate add function. And I forget, I mean, funky. This was 15 years ago that I looked at this. I forget the exact math behind it, but by doing that, they exploited like the underflow to do some extra work on updating like both the U and V coordinates were like added in a single instruction by they were storing them in like the two halves of the 64-bit or the 32-bit value, and then they'd do a subtract with borrow and the underflow would like
magically
pulling both, do the U addition in the upper 16 bits while not damaging the V addition in the lower 16 bits.
Well, that's Michael Abrash, right? So
yeah,
he gets to do whatever he wants pretty much. I saw, we did one of those, something like that, not really like that, but Rain Simulation, where we counted on the fact that the integer would overflow and wrap back around. And I forget the trick, which is why I didn't mention it earlier. But basically, you just keep adding all the time. And since the integer will wrap, you're fine. You don't ever need to do, you don't need to do an if per raindrop kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
There's a story I read once about someone, it might have been on Stack Overflow, of someone trying to reverse engineer this old assembly code that ran on a mainframe that someone had retired.
Oh, I think I know what story you're going to say. And it has to do with the tape speed or something, right?
No, actually, but that sounds awesome too. You should tell that.
I can't remember.
This one was, it got into some piece of code that had a problem, and he's debugging it. He's going through it line by line in the assembly code, and there's this little chunk of code that it jumps to that he knows by observing the system that it leaves that piece of code, that it, you know, it's a loop, it iterates a certain number of times, then it leaves. But there's no jump instruction in that loop to leave. Mm. So it's code that only has an in. Like there's a path in. There's no path out.
Once you go in,
but
you
it does leave. Mm. Yeah, that's what. If you read the code, you can just tell. You look like, hey, the only way to get out of this is to jump, and there's no jump instruction. So how does he get out of the loop? And the way he gets out of the loop is by some crazy bitwise operator math that in certain circumstances, depending on the conditions of what was passed in, after a certain number of iterations, it overflows one of the registers so that it then contains the jump instruction and then it executes the jump.
Oh, that's horrible. Computers are horrible.
Yeah. Self-modifying code, like that's the ultimate, like, insane hack. Like, fortunately, that even predates me. Like, I don't have any good self-modifying code stories. That's like the previous generation of programmers. But that's, yeah, to me, that seems as nuts as probably using the stack pointer as a general purpose register would seem to anyone in the games industry now.
Yeah, everything's so much easier these days.
Yep.
But then people who are programming 5 or 10 years or 20 years from now will hear our stories of the horrific things. You know, we produced assets manually at multiple resolutions. We had the 1x and the 2x for Retina, and you know, we have bitmaps for our files for the images.
Why didn't you just store it all as vector graphics? Exactly. That's what everyone does now.
I've had probably an argument with someone about why are operating systems not entirely vector rendered at least once a year for like 10 years now. And it's one of those things that a computing scientist thinks is obvious, and a developer who deals with performance in user interfaces thinks is insane. And it's really hard to have that conversation of like, yes, of course it would be great if everything could. Oh, and then also there's the designers that chime in, and they want every pixel to look in a very specific way.
Right. I think there was a Linux distribution that did that, or whatever.
Yeah. Distribution. Like, quite some time ago.
Yeah.
And so now we have these operating systems that are dealing with, you know, 2x Retina or scales in between. And, you know, maybe now we're going to have at 4x iPad 12-inch devices where we're going to have even more assets with giant gigabyte Photoshop files. It's like this Linux distribution solved the problem 10 years ago, except that it was crazy slow and the visual fidelity of the assets was terrible at small sizes and, you know, little
visual
minor
fidelity. It looked like crap is what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
It's a nice way of putting it.
That's but I'm pretty sure that the issue in their system, the bug tracker, did not
probably
say
not right. Visual fidelity.
And that's like the thing with icon design is that the exact mathematical, and fonts are the same way. It seems like you can just make an exact mathematical representation of the font and then render it anywhere in between 8 pixels tall and 1 million pixels tall, and it will just look right. Whereas in practice, what's mathematically right is not optically right, especially at small sizes.
Right.
So.
Yeah, got to tweak it.
So how's Napkin?
Pretty good. I don't know. It's doing okay. We've got an update coming up pretty soon, 1.2.
Any insane performance hacks?
No, actually. In fact, I just got a review saying it was really slow on somebody's machine, so that's not a good. That's not good for my.
Well, now that you have the trash can Mac Pro,
yeah, you'll be able to very accurately test the performance of stuff on a totally ordinary Mac that any of your users could be using.
It's funny. I've got this really fancy Mac Pro, and actually the first work it did on it was actually speeding something up in Napkin. I forget what it was, something to do with image rendering, but it was already really, really fast on the machine, but I just noticed it. Like I noticed it spiked in a performance thing I did, and I was like, oh, okay, I got to go fix it.
So, it's definitely good. Nigel and I, we have our iPhone upgrade cycles one off from each other, partially just a chance, but also any given, whichever one of us is on the previous generation is more often to be filing bug reports for performance on the app because, you know, yeah, if I had the 5S, then I probably wouldn't think about it. But all those little perceptions where you press a button and then there's like a full second before the dialogue comes up and there's no user right. interface reaction for that. You know that if on the 4S it's like that, then on the 4, which unfortunately I still need to support, it's going to be terrible. So
yeah, no one runs the 4 as their main phones, or even the 4S anymore. I guess I was on the 4S until the 5S came out, but now the 4 and the 4S are just the test devices sitting on our desk that who knows how often they're going to get run with. So
right, are they still shipping the 4S? No,
yeah, I believe so.
For the 4, they stopped, right?
They definitely stopped in North America. From what I understand, they do sometimes ship the old ones somewhere else, like in developing markets or something like that. But they haven't necessarily stopped making them. I don't know if that's true of the 4 or not, but they definitely don't sell it in North America.
I believe
anymore.
That's just refurbs. I don't think they're manufacturing the 4
or the 5. Either way, they're still getting out in the world, right?
Yeah, and there's lots of them. Yeah. Like we're used to the early days on iOS where newcomers to the platform come in so fast that you can assume most people are on the latest one or two devices, because even though people don't necessarily upgrade every year, it's just this hockey stick exponential growth. Whereas now, there's still a hell of a lot of people buying new devices, but it's no longer growing so dramatically. And so there's a lot of people who just are still buying and using apps on, like, we get bug reports for Wedding DJ on a lot of people use like the third gen or second gen iPod Touch, whatever the oldest possible, the absolute slowest iOS device that can run. I think that we actually still support iOS 6 because we're
crazy. An app that may find its way on older devices a lot. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Basically, it's not a nerd's app.
Exactly.
It's like, I need to do DJing for my wedding, and you type in wedding DJ, and guess what you get? You know, that, which is great, but it means that you probably do have a broader spectrum of support than, say, I don't know, something like Vesper or even a Twitter, maybe Twitter clients abroad.
No, do you know what I mean? You're absolutely right. And I do the support still, which I think is a good exercise. But I see only for Wedding DJ, not for any of the other apps that we have, but Wedding DJ, I see quite a few support requests where it never would have even occurred to me that someone could not know that, which is funny because I did tech support. It was my first job. But like people, one of the classic ones years ago was someone's like, oh, okay, well, I downloaded Wedding DJ, I bought it, and I'm excited to use it, but I can't get it installed on my iPod. And I'm like, okay, well, which generation of iPod Touch do you have?
Right.
And they're like, oh, it's a Nano. And
you're like, well, okay.
Okay.
I think I've determined your problem.
Yeah, it seems to be right here. And so, I mean, it's great in that I can immediately solve their problem by offering them a refund link, and that I can't feel bad because it's physically impossible to fix that. But it's interesting. And I had another one the other day where someone's like, oh, when I double click Wedding DJ, it doesn't run, which is a really bad sign when they say double click.
Right.
They'd managed to download the app bundle on the Mac and then like put it in the applications folder. But it's like, and then the iOS app, and it does nothing, and it just...
How do you even do... I guess they're accessible from iTunes, aren't they? Like, you can just...
Yeah, but you'd think if you could dig... Well, I guess it's not hidden or anything, right? You can go... But it's weird. You'd think if you know enough to dig into your iTunes folder to get the IPA, you would know that it's not an app.
Yeah, you would think. It also could have been that somebody helped them. They're like, hey, how do I get a file into applications? Or how do I find the app I bought or something, but not necessarily what they're trying to do?
Exactly. Somebody, you ask the wrong question and somebody gives you the accurate answer and then you're just totally down the garden path.
Yeah. So definitely it's an interesting, but I mean, it's a good challenge because it means that once you actually get, assuming that you have a device that can actually run the app, that once it's running, we're forced to make it so that it's so easy to use that if those people can use it that are not technical at all, then the people who are relatively technical can have a really nice experience.
That's great. And, you know, I mean, well, besides making money, what you want is people to have a good wedding, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's
you want people to actually just go and have fun with the app. You don't want them. Whatever, you're making the world a better place is what I'm saying.
Oh, thanks. It's definitely one of those things where the combination of less technical users and the high stakes kind of play.
That's Thank you. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm trying to touch on. But
yeah, because if you're...
I don't have the visual fidelity for it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, a lot of the time, the app is like, you use it once, and it your wedding works, and that's good, or it ruins your wedding, which is like very horrible, so...